Hello, hello.
Hi, everybody.
So, today I'm about to call in about 5 minutes. I'm going to call E. Michael Jones, and we're going to continue our really, really fun talks. But first, I wanted to read a letter from a great man who sent me and just something that I'm not worthy of, but I'll do my best. This was the hatchet that the bear was talking about on one of the streams, and so I rushed to the post office to make sure I got it, and I want to make sure I read his entire letter because this was just very, very touching for me. And then I'll call E. Michael Jones, who is just such a breath of fresh air. So, dear Owen, I hope this gift finds you in overall wellness. Over the past year, I've been going through a medical discharge from the U.S. Army from wounds sustained in combat in Afghanistan. In this past year, I've done what many other American men have done, that being asking questions about why society is going to shit and realigning many other personal objectives. I started out listening to Shapiro, which you pointed out was a good starting point to clear some fog, temporarily. But within 6 months of Shapiro, I began to question his authenticity. Through listening to many others, I eventually found your live stream when you were about 130,000 strong. Now I tune in pretty much every night to listen, and now tune into Vox Day thanks to your recommendation. Vox is great, the man. And have now joined unauthorized.tv. You won't be disappointed. I'm currently stationed at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, so I usually don't finish, but I'll pick up where I left off the next morning. In short, I want to reach out and personally send you my thanks and gratitude for what you're doing. You are a patriot. You gave clarity to many individuals who are caught up in the dangerous web of psychological subversion. Buddy, you're going to love today's convo with E. Michael Jones. And with this, you are a leader providing guidance and leadership in the form of not just humor, but critical thinking, and thus reaffirming to many our American patriotism, pride, and the grit of what it means to be an American. Enclosed is a gift to you that was given to me when I was with conventional forces back in 2012-2013 at Fort Polk, Louisiana. It is now a symbol that signifies how I view your efforts in the patriotic service that you have taken up. The hatchet you now have was presented to me when I was in company executive officer. Here's a picture. Hey, check this out. Isn't that sick? Look at the hatchet. Executive officer with 2nd Battalion, 4th Infantry Regiment of the 4th Brigade Combat Team, Light Infantry, 10th Mountain Division of the United States Army. It is now reflagged as the 3rd Brigade Combat Team due to force realignment. 3rd Brigade Combat Team is known as the Patriot Brigade. You will see on one side of the hatchet our brigade motto, Forge for War. Where am I? And on the other side is my old call sign, Iroquois 5. The hatchets are presented to the company battalion and brigade commander teams throughout the Patriot Brigade. As my career as an Army officer comes to a close, and not to be corny, but I want to give you the hatchet, as I feel it symbolizes the patriotic leader that you are. I hope this gift will remind you of the positive influence you have to not just American men, but all Americans as a whole. I have also included some pictures of U.S. Army officers and senior non-commissioned officers signed to the now 3rd Brigade Combat Team Patriot Brigade and have their hatchets during a pass and review parade, so you know it's not bullshit. I appreciate that. I can tell it's not, but I have been tricked in the past. You also notice that some hatchets have 6.5-inch blades and others have 7.5-inch blade. Yours is a 7.5 blade. There's no significance to the difference in blade size. It was an error in our supply chain when they were ordered. However, I think it's a better-looking hatchet. Haha. Also enclosed are a couple pictures of me when I was a combat advisor with Commando Special Operations Advisory Group, Special Operations Joint Task Force Afghanistan. I know you've had some friends that have bullshitted you about their service, so I included these photos of myself, so you know I'm not BSing you. I spent about half of my Army career in conventional forces and the other half in special operations forces. Anyway, as of right now, my medical discharge will finalize on March 21st, and I will be moving back home to Spokane, in May of 2019. Not sure if you've ever done a show there one day. I hope you do. Just because of you, I will, my friend. If you ever find yourself there for a show, and if you're, we should do one at the, all right, I'll tell you a second. If you ever find yourself there for a show, and if you're willing, of course, I'd like to coordinate a joint audience between the local VFW chapters, Veterans of Foreign War, in the area. I know veterans serving from Vietnam to Syria would find your humor as a breath of fresh air, and most importantly, funny as hell. I'm not currently aligned with the VFW in the area yet, but I will be heavily involved once I get there. With that, and again, with you being able to, please let me know what the costs and charges would be to arrange. Buddy, I will do it for just to fundraise to help any vets that need financial help. I won't take a penny, and you have my word on that. You know, maybe gas money, and it depends if I'm having beers. I can cover the hotel and beers if I have beers, but if I'm still not drinking, no, there's no charge. My dude, are you kidding me? This is the whole point of doing things for your community. Like, you gave me this. Do you think I would charge? That's insanity. We could do such a fundraiser for any vet that needs help financially. As long as they're vetted, that they aren't full of shit, I would be honored to do a show for you guys and not... That's the whole point of super chats and support and all that. It's like, I don't have to make any money on it. As long as I can pay my bills and stuff, we can... Because I don't want to pay a lot of taxes. What, that's the whole thing. Like, when I talk about how pay your taxes and stuff, you should. But, like, also, if you can figure out a life where you don't have to pay much taxes because you live a simple life and you put it back into the community, that's ideal. So, from the bottom of my heart, man, that gift was so touching. And I'm glad that you kicked me in the ass a little bit to go get it from the post office. Means the world to me. And I would absolutely love to do a show for you guys. All right. So now Owen's humor is military humor. I know, that's the irony. It's like when the swamp nonsense machines like Ben Shapiro, who just constantly want to put these heroes into harm's way for wars that don't matter, like Iran, you know, and they call someone like me unpatriotic. No, I have a deep, I have such a deep and undying respect for my nation and for the military that I find it very insulting that these people are so war hawkish when they're not the ones serving. That's the complete irony to all of this. Just the deep irony is my love for my country and for the military is why I call out these snakes. All right, so let's call E. Michael Jones. I can't wait to play him a little clip about gay politicians because he wants to talk about gay politicians. All right, so let me call E. Michael Jones real quick. And there we go. Let's get this going. Is he here?
Hello.
Hey, what's going on, my friend?
Good. We're having a great time here in South Bend.
Yeah, dude. It was so funny because I'm glad your response just made me belly laugh. I was like, you know, what do you want to talk about? And you just were off the just immediately like our gay mayor that in his narcissistic delusions thinks he can be president. So let's talk about it. Am I having connection issues? You got to be kidding
me. He's enjoying his 15 minutes of fame.
Yeah.
He's enjoying his 15 minutes of fame now. He's been on every single talk show. He was on Ellen DeGeneres yesterday. He's been on Colbert. He's been on everything. So this is it. He better enjoy it because the reaction is now going to set in. There are people now who want to come to South Bend and find out if this is really true. And it's not true, of course. This is the David Axelrod using Pritzker family money. These are the people that created Obama a few years back, and now they're going to create another. This is going to be an even bigger, a bigger creation than Obama. We're going to have Obama was a senator from Illinois. This guy is mayor of South Bend. He's going to go right to the White House because he's a homosexual.
But they overplayed their hand. I'm sure you know that as much as anybody. I think the population is kind of aware of the magic trick at this point. So I don't think it's possible. And as we talked before about how Jews and sodomites have taken over comedy, I got a clip up for you that I want to play for you because I think you'll find it slightly cathartic, where I was making fun of the gay governor of Colorado. They're not buying it anymore. You want to just hear like a 2-minute comedy clip?
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Check this out. Okay. Bear in mind, I have to perform in a children's museum because the theater system and the comedy club system has blackballed me. But, you know, we did multiple shows and sold it out in a day. But watch the crowd reaction to sodomy-driven politics. All right, here we go. And then I'll be right back. I just think you'll find this cathartic.
Like, what, you might be good. Like, wait 20 years. Work on your skill. Don't put it on a wall to be ridiculed. Walk around this place. I just see garbage. Just... These little kids are just making nonsense art. They put it on the wall. People tell them it's good. That's what leads to getting a gay governor. No one cares about his policies at all. None. None. And it's like when you criticize this, someone's like, oh, you would not allow a gay governor. I'm like, don't care where he puts his cock. Just kind of want to know what his policy things are. Like, what does he want to do for your state? He's like, well, he's pro-sodomy and worth $400 million, so what could go wrong? And the worst part isn't that people agree with him. It's they don't know what he believes. Like, people just vote for people based on, like, it's like, does he put it in butts? It's like, no, but it's about, you know, it's a job. They work for us. It's like, well, what's the policy? Are you going to do taxes? Are you going to keep, you know, illegal aliens from legally defecating on your own sidewalks? It's like, doesn't matter. He fucks butts.
All right. So that's just a little bit into why there's a reason why they're trying to make comedy that actually makes people laugh obsolete, is because you can hear the crowd response. That's not canned laughter. That's people being like, yes, finally, we're talking about how, you know, they're putting in gay politicians so that you can't question the tyranny.
That's right. That's exactly the point. That's exactly the point. So what is let's do Logos 101. Okay.
Okay.
Logos 101. The anus is not a sex organ. There is a logos to the body, to the human body. Every part has its own purpose, its own function, and this is not that. Okay. Now, given the fact that this man believes that, he believes the opposite of what I just said. If he can redefine that, he can redefine anything. He can redefine the whole universe according to his own principles, because he's a homosexual and he is completely immune from any type of criticism. So he can criticize Mike Pence. He just did this recently. Mike Pence is a bad Christian because he does not follow his religion in the same way that Pete follows his religion. Well, wait a minute, Pete. You made your religion up. So that means you must be a step above God.
Right.
Because when I heard it, religion had to do with God, and God was the man who made up these, okay, with 10 commandments. So you've come up with a religion where you've eliminated one of those commandments, and nobody's allowed to say anything about it. This is the position we're in. The more power these people get, the more they will be determined to make you go along with a system where there's no logos. They will force you to accept their anti-logos as the normal way of life.
Yeah, and homosexuals do make a great slave or a great double agent, because as you described, they're already put in a position where they're playing, they have multiple personalities. Like they have allegiance to multiple masters, and that weakens the politician. And that's when you start seeing that there's a reason why they're highlighting these fringe populations for power, things make a lot of sense. Like, your work has helped a lot of people, because pure chaos and confusion is so much harder to deal with than the hard truths of logos.
Yeah. I mean, and this didn't happen overnight. I mean, I've talked before about the whole Black Jewish Alliance. For 70 years, the Jews created things like the NAACP, the Anti-Defamation League, to basically turn the blacks into their proxy warriors. That collapsed in 1967. for a lot of different reasons. The Arab-Israeli War, Harold Cruz's book, The Crisis of the Negro Intellectual.
I think I lost you.
The Warriors at this point. Yeah. So they needed a new group, and the new group turned out to be the homosexuals. Because they've made a commitment. There is an intentional community here, whereas blacks is just an ethnic group. It's just a group of people. Now there's a group of people who are committed to basically overturning the social order because their lives are lived in contradiction to any possible social order.
Yeah, and that's so much more efficient. Oh, sorry. I got a weak connection for some reason, but we'll fight through it. They're trying to attack Logos. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay, cool. Yeah, and just like I love how you describe how it's not the Jewish ethnicity that makes them such nonsense machines. It's the rejection of Logos, because I think the oligarchs have realized that there isn't really the slave ethnicity that they thought. You know, the black proxy warrior didn't work as well. It's when someone chooses to live a life against the natural law, that's when they can really be slaves.
That's right. Because in a sense, you've abandoned the moral law. You've abandoned it because you want to get what you want. You want to do what you want to do. I'm willing to pay any price. I'll abandon the moral law. Well, if you abandon the moral law, you abandon reason. And if you abandon reason, well, what are you? You're not in control anymore. They're in control of you. This is the way this works, as a form of control.
Yeah, and the one thing that human beings, that all of us have as a weapon against tyranny, is simply saying that's wrong, that's not right. And so
if you say, okay, I am not going to say that anymore because I have abandoned the moral law, you can't say that. And they know that. They know that. They lured you into a trap. You know, I'll give you permission to act on your perverse desires if you don't question me. Well, you can't question the oligarchs because you abandoned the moral law. That's the only basis for any type of questioning.
Yeah, and it's a real parasitic relationship that these oligarchs have with these proxy warriors. It's almost like pimps and hookers, where it's like, I keep your abusive secrets and you keep my abusive secrets. It's like the hooker gets to do the drugs or whatever sin got them into the lifestyle. And in return, they get protection. And neither one of them rats on each other's rejection of Logos. And you're seeing that now with politics, where it's like, well, kind of like what you talked about with Foucault, where it sets up this disgusting cycle where it's like, I let you run rampant in the homosexual bathhouses as long as you don't question our tyranny. And it's crazy how much people will submit to tyranny. You know, even so, I don't do sarcasm anymore because I feel like it's a form of self-tyranny, where it's like, well, I guess now we just have tranny children. It's like, no, we don't. Yes means yes, no means no. Like, you can't go down that cynical road, or else they got a chain around your neck, you know?
Yeah.
So what do you think is going to happen? Like, do you think this Petey guy has any shot, or do you think that the rabbit's been pulled out of there?
I think what they're thinking is that the whole Trump phenomenon was a mirage. It was an aberration, and that now we can get back to normal, which is basically the mass media telling us what to do and what to think. I think that this is what they're betting on. And they kind of have doubled down on Pete because he's a lot harder to sell in some sense than Obama was, because homosexuality is not just like being black or half black.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Exactly.
It's based on actions that are in defiance of Logos, and everybody knows that. You know, nobody can pretend they don't know that. So it's a more of a challenge, but I think that's exactly the way they feel. That these, we can do anything, nothing has really changed. We have the most powerful propaganda ministry in history. We can make people say black is white and peace is war, and we can get this guy from South Bend into the White House. Watch us do it.
Yeah, it's,
but the problem here is that the consciousness has changed.
Yep.
I mean, it wasn't. I said this before about South Bend. It wasn't Trump. He was the surfer on the wave. The important thing was the wave, and that was the people of Indiana waking up to the fact that the oligarchs had two parties to represent their interests, and the people of Indiana had nobody to represent their interests. And Pete is the classic example of the oligarch's carpetbagger, who comes into South Bend. He claims he got 80% of the vote. He got 80% of the 11% who showed up at the polls.
Yeah.
Because Democratic Party, the corrupt Democratic Party, controls St. Joseph County. So after he ran against four other guys in the primary, that's the only election that counts in St. Joe County, is the primary, the Democratic primary. Then he gets, as the incumbent, well, then you can announce it because the Republican has no chance of winning. So that was that. It's one phony story after another here.
Yeah, and as you've said in the past, they're drunk on power. And it's like, it's almost like the wounded deer jumps highest. I think deep, deep, deep down in their subconscious, they know that the cat's out of the bag. So that's why now they're just swinging. They're swinging for homers. You know, they have this weird duality of crazy ego and crippling insecurity. And that's why they're just trying to throw this gay guy into our face. And the quote unquote working class, which I don't even understand that term, because that implies that there's a class that isn't working. Was there a parasitic class, you know, working class and non-working class? But working class people aren't as susceptible at all to the propaganda a bit, because they don't have, you know, 5 million on the stock market, and they don't just hobnob with a bunch of people that went to, you know, some ridiculous college, you know, Skidmore. So I don't know if these people actually know how few people are falling for the trick anymore. You know, even the Zionist AIPAC, it's like that woman, that Muslim woman who said that, you know, Jews basically run our college or our Congress. The reaction proved her point, and everyone saw it. You know, even if you disagree with her, which, you know, she seems like a weirdo to me, like married her brother, and I don't, you know, like people who believe in caliphates and whatnot, but it's so interesting when someone says something and the reaction proves their point. You know, she was like, it's all about the Benjamins with AIPAC, and everyone was like, shut her down. And I was like, I never would have even listened to her if it wasn't for this heinous reaction. You know, Trump had a similar phenomenon.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think you're seeing the reaction in the censoring on the internet, because that's a direct contradiction of the last thing we are allowed to believe. In other words, that we have freedom of speech. We don't have any money. We lost our job. The jobs are going to Mexico, but at least we have freedom of speech. Well, no, we don't have that either.
No.
Well, every time they censor you, they're admitting that they lost the argument.
Exactly. And it's pathetic. You know, like, YouTube demonetized me and literally stole $50,000 in back pay from people that gave it to me. It wasn't even advertising. It was people becoming members, you know, voluntary, and they took it all, no explanation. And they think that's going to break people like me, and all it does is let me know how accurate we are. Where, you know, they rely on us to have a love of money to fall for their nonsense. And the more they do that, the more they try and entice you with the things that they are enticed by, the more you can see right through their BS.
Yeah. Well, every time they do that, they are proving that you were right. So the other side of the coin is, do you think that YouTube would be successful if everybody on it was politically correct? Can't we go to a university to find professors who are politically correct?
Yeah, but see, I'm starting to think that they don't care about money, that they just, you know, it's kind of like they almost just seem to print the money to beat out all the competition that can speak with any sense of logos, you know? Like they just,
it was the alternative to the mainstream media. So the only reason people go to YouTube is because you can say things there that no one would dream of saying on the mainstream media. So if YouTube censors that, they're cutting their own throat. Why would you do that? Don't you want to be popular?
I know. That's why I think I'm starting to get this weird feeling that these high level companies like Google, YouTube, they aren't motivated at all by money. It's almost like they have some sort of money printing press and they can just print out of existence. You know, like MySpace, they gave $800 million to get them out of the way and to bring in Facebook that seems to be controlled by oligarchs. I think that this printing of nonsense debt-based currency is on a level of control, and it doesn't even require popularity or ads. It's not free market. Like, the free market itself is a nonsense idea, but it's not even close to that. It's completely controlled by the Federal Reserve and all these money printers.
Yeah, and they will destroy that too, because the reason that the dollar is powerful is because it's the world reserve currency. So if Mr. Mnuchin keeps putting people under sanctions, right now we have 40% of the world's population living under sanctions from the United States Treasury Department. They will destroy, every time they do that, they're putting one more nail in the coffin of the dollar as the world's reserve currency. And at a certain point, that's going to break, and that will be the end of the American empire. No matter how many aircraft carriers we have, that will be the end of the American empire.
Yeah, it's almost like that image of the gun with the barrel pointing back at the person. Like, you don't realize you're shooting yourself. You know, like, what we're doing is unifying Iran, Russia, China, this giant Eurasian economic powerhouse, and our nonsense squares of power will become obsolete. I was going to ask you, like, didn't that happen in the 14th century with the Venetians, with a currency collapse? I was trying to look through history to figure out other times when these oligarchs have pushed the nonsense currency too far for control and everything kind of fell apart, and then out of that came the Renaissance. I was wondering if that's accurate at all.
Well, the currency at the time of the Renaissance was gold. The ducat was the gold coin of Venice, and the florin was the gold coin of Florence. And those coins were never in circulation. They were rarely, if ever, in circulation. They were only for the oligarchs, economic transactions between states. The common people had to use silver currency, and the silver currency was constantly debased in this period of time, just as it was in the at the time of the Roman Empire. And so you were constantly cheating the working people out of decent ways by paying what claimed to be the same amount of money, but was really a debased coin, which was only half. And so as soon as they got the debased coin, suddenly they realized everything was costing twice as much. So that was the problem up until that time. The problem with gold is that there is never enough gold to keep up with human productivity. You know, human productivity is the engine that drives the economy. Your labor is the source of all value, and if you're constantly pegging human labor to gold, the amount of gold, you're never going to have enough money to have the economy circulate properly, money circulating in the economy properly. That was the chronic problem all the way up until the invention of paper money, all the way up till when the Dutch realized that you didn't have to have all of that gold. You could issue pieces of paper that were 10 times the amount of gold that you had in the basement, and nobody would ever know. And that was the beginning of the modern economy.
And yet, you've highlighted the Hitler's economist, you know, because that created a currency based on labor. How did that work, and why can't we do that again?
We can do it. We can do it tomorrow if you wanted to. That was Hjalmar Schacht. He was the one who created the big inflation. He deliberately created that huge inflation in the Weimar Republic in the 1920s to pay off debts. Inflation is the way you pay off debts. I had met a governor of the Fed in Cleveland who told me that. He said, basically, well, if we go, the inflation rate is 3%, and we let it rise to 6%, we will cut the debt in half. That's traditionally the way sovereigns pay off debt, by inflating the currency. So Schacht did that in the 20s. Hitler came to power. Hitler called him back at this point. In the 20s, to restart the economy, he borrowed gold from Montague Norman, the Englishman, and the guy who ran the Fed in America. In the 30s, he realized they're not going to do that anymore. We can do it without gold. Well, what did he do? He realized that, what is money? Money is a picture of the sovereign. You can print that picture on a, you can impress it on a piece of gold, in which case you're guaranteeing that the gold is an ounce of gold, which is what you're saying it is, and that's called a coin. Or you can put it on a piece of paper. In this instance, money becomes credit, and it becomes credit based on the future labor of the country. So if you have a labor force that is productive, you can issue X amount of dollars or marks or whatever it is, as long as you don't exceed the size of the economy, which politicians always want to do. Right. So the classic is doing the opposite would be Zimbabwe. So the guy who's in charge of Zimbabwe says, oh, you mean I can print the money? Well, let's print $1 billion. Well, you don't have a $1 billion economy. So your money's going to be worthless because no one will accept it. But Schacht, during the 30s, realized we have a powerful economy. I will start issuing money up to that point, and people will take that money, and they will buy things with it, and the economy will start. He's the only one, Hitler and Schacht, the only people that got out of the Depression because they had the courage of their convictions in terms of what money was, credit on future labor.
Yeah, but
Franklin Roosevelt never did that.
But how do you not, what you were saying, though, how do you not over inflate your future labor? Like, how do you not, that's why Logos in the form of Christianity, it's the only way, it's the only true way, is so necessary for people. Because if you don't have a sense of morality and right and wrong, you will get someone in power that says, our future labor is worth, it's not just $1 billion, it's $2 billion, $8 billion, you know, and then the corruption sets in. How do you avoid that corruption? Like, how do you set up an economy where someone can't just get into the printing press and start going to town?
That's the answer is called the moral law.
Yes, right.
You can't lie. You cannot lie about the size of the economy. That's a moral imperative. Okay? What I'm trying to say here is not a self-regulating machine. This is what Adam Smith tried to say. You know, with Wealth of Nations, this has been the fiction of English economy all along, that basically he took Newton's system, which is there's gravity and inertia. Okay, we're going to say that's competition and self-interest. All you need is to put competition together with self-interest, and everything will work out fine. That's wrong. Economics is a moral science. It's based on choices of people trying to achieve the good. That's morality. Adam Smith was a professor of moral philosophy. He knew that, and he tried to come up with some type of Newtonian alternative that would regulate itself, and it never works. That's the biggest fiction that has wrecked economies ever since he came up with the idea. We don't need type of moral intervention in the economy. The economy will take care of itself all by itself.
Yeah, my buddy Vox actually disproved free markets to me, and it was somewhat devastating because, you know, I'll always admit when I'm wrong because I don't want to walk around wrong, but I always thought that the free market was the best way to have consent. But he showed that free market also is free. The labor transfers are so evil, you know, like when you have populations that are willing to work for less, you don't get an American family, an American community. And as you talked about in your book, the death of, what was it called? When you talked about Detroit in the cities and the deaths of the cities, that's
the slaughter of cities.
Yeah,
slaughter of cities.
That's a result of the state-sponsored usury that is this free market capitalism. Do you recommend, because I think economics is so tied with our morality problems right now. Tariffs? Like, how would you structure, and I know it's too complicated, but just in general, how would you structure the economy?
I'll give you a real simple example. I just got back from 3 weeks in Kenya. Okay, Kenya, East Africa, the whole country. You go around there, I'm coming into a city called, I went to Western Kenya this time, left Nairobi, went to Western Kenya, lived on a little farm called Ashamba. We go into this town called Bungoma. It's the ugliest place I've ever seen in my life. And what you see there in the marketplace is acres of used clothing. They even have a word for it. They call it mutumba. The Swahili word for used clothing. All of this stuff comes from the Goodwill boxes in America. It goes to Jewish rag pickers in New Jersey. They sort it out and they ship it to Kenya, and this makes an economy impossible. The priest I met in Bungoma said he went to school. His father put him to school by growing cotton. There is not one cotton seed left in Bungoma because of Mutumba. This is because of free market. This is the free market in action. This cheap shit flows into East Africa and it destroys the economy. Nobody can plant cotton this happened in 1985 in Tanzania when Nyerere died. Didn't die, he retired. The next president takes over. He lets Mutumba into Tanzania, and within 2 years, he wiped out the entire garment industry. They wiped out the entire garment industry in Kenya. 50,000 tailors. The guy I met in Nairobi told me he went there to arrived in Nairobi in 1960. You couldn't buy a shirt in Nairobi. You had to go to a tailor who would make you a shirt. This is the source of wealth. There is only one way out of poverty historically, and that is the production of cloth. That was the way out of poverty, the transition from a subsistence economy in Italy to a manufacturing economy in the 14th century was cloth. Same thing in Germany in the 16th century. Same thing for England in the 18th century. Same thing for America in the 19th century. And the same thing for China in the 20th century. Every single country that has moved from subsistence economy to a manufacturing economy and the wealth that comes from that did it by producing cloth. Now, what this Mutumba does is it prevents that manufacturing base from forming in all of East Africa. So in 2015, the people, Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, Rwanda, all get together and they erect tariffs to keep out Mutumba. Guess what happens then? The Jewish rag pickers from New Jersey go to Mr. Mnuchin, the Secretary of the Treasury, and say, they are destroying our business. And Mnuchin immediately puts sanctions on these countries, and the countries back down.
Unreal.
They back down like that. Because Kenya, they threatened Kenya. Kenya had $70 million or some minuscule amount of money of exports to the United States, and they threatened, well, we will never buy anything from Kenya anymore if you do this. What they should have said, fine, we don't need your exports. We are going to stick with the tariffs, and we are going to create our own economy here.
Exactly.
That's what they should have done.
Exactly. That's the way out. And by the way, there's 3,200 people right now seeking Logos. So if anyone has a question, paypal.me/feedthebear. Send me a message. Keep it direct for Dr. Jones. I'll ask him. But all right. So like in my little neighborhood, because I reach a limit where I can't just think about these oligarchs and these men in tiny hats, or I just, it's not beneficial to me. So now me and my neighbors, you know, we exchange eggs. We're going to go in on some goats. It's almost like the way out is just to be like, we're not gonna be able to be bought off by your debt based, you know, your usury or your sodomy enticements. You know, that's literally the only way out. You have to almost make your own community. Like, it's money isn't evil. The love of money is evil, or the submission because of money. How do you feel about that? Is that a way out? Like, how do you beat these people?
Well, you have reached such an advanced level here. I mean, we've all have reached the fact that we're talking here on the internet. You were making money off the internet, okay? We have a very advanced economy, and if you fire you from Hollywood, you're smart enough to figure out something else, another way to make money. You fire me from St. Mary's, I end up starting a magazine. We have these skills. They do not have those skills in Africa. They've never been able to develop them. And so that's what they have to do now. The biggest thing that helped people here in the United States when my Irish grandfather came here in 1900, he went to Philadelphia and he immediately got a job at the Baldwin Locomotive Factory in Philadelphia. It was a good paying job. It taught him how to work. He developed skills there, and then he went out on his own and created a hardware store, and he did very well for himself just off the boat. Yeah. That's because you had this powerful economic infrastructure that was good at turning labor into wealth. That's the only way you can turn labor into wealth, because labor is the source of all value. And that's that simple.
And it's also like the minimum wage I've also always found very evil, because I used to work jobs for very, very little, whether it was a paper boy or I used to collect cans out of dumpsters. And if you apply that to apprenticeship or just working as little as you're worth, you can get skills to then move up. Where if you make a $18 minimum wage job, it's cheaper for somebody to create a machine. It seems like there's no way out for some people. You know, like when I started in comedy, I didn't get paid for the first like 2 years. You know, I was doing stand up. Right. There was a union that said every comedian had to make X amount of money. I didn't bring that value. I didn't have any TV credits yet or movie credits. I didn't have an audience. I was willing to work every night for free to get those skills and develop an audience. And with a minimum wage enforced by, you know, the government, I would not have been able to do that.
The minimum wage is based on a good idea, which is basically that you need wages are the main way that money gets into the economy. But the minimum wage is a kind of stopgap measure that kicks in because wages have been driven too low. We have the
froze. Ah, come on. They iced me.
Can you hear me now?
I got you. Yeah, they do this in and out buffering thing, but you went out right. Let me make sure we're still streaming. It's not, but it could be. This is a psychological thing that I don't know if it's on purpose or not, but I suspect it is. Hang on a second. Let me double check if the streaming is still working. It's still going. All right, cool. Yeah, you cut off right as you were talking about a stopgap measure because
wages are too low.
Yeah.
So the classic example was Florence in the 15th century when Cosimo de' Medici comes to power.
Come on.
To raise wages, they are going to grind the worker. And at that point, they bring the Jews in because they need to get money from that working class that they're not paying enough. So the working class, working man now has to go to the Jew to borrow money at 43 1/3% interest to pay his taxes. This eventually killed the economy. It killed Florence. By the time the century ended, Florence was the museum that it is today. Because they killed the source of wealth, which was the manufacture of cloth. That is what made Florence wealthy. It was wool cloth. And Florence was famous for their wool throughout all of Europe. And the Medici family first made its money from manufacturing wool cloth. And then they took that money, and instead of reinvesting it in the worker, they got into banking and they got into usury. And that's the whole story. This is all in Barron Metal. My History of Capitalism is the conflict between labor and usury. It's always this conflict between labor and usury. The Jew says, like Shylock, that my ducats can copulate faster than Laban's ewes and rams. The Jew thinks he can make money by not working. The Christian alternative is what the Benedictines said. It was ora et labora. Okay? Labor is the only source of value. If you cheat labor, you're cutting off your nose to spite your face. That is the problem with our economy. It's always a race to the bottom.
Exactly.
We're always trying to find some cheap labor force in India, okay, so that we can make more money by stealing the surplus value that those people create when they create a product. Yeah. I'll give you a classic example here, okay? A girl power T-shirt. Girl power, written here. That T-shirt costs $39. You put it on your daughter so that she can advertise feminism, okay? Well, where did that T-shirt come from? Well, it came from India. Well, who made it? Well, women made it, and they're being paid 48 cents an hour so that your daughter can parade around and advertise feminism.
Yeah, and that's what's also affecting comedy is life itself is becoming an upside down irony because of this not like this whole rejection of natural law makes everything ridiculous. It's like what you were talking about with Nero, how he married his boyfriend and put a horse in Senate. It's becoming a very evil comedy. And another perfect example is bringing women into the workforce so that you can get more money, but then all you did was make labor half as valuable, and now kids don't have moms, you know?
That's right. So that's what happened. What was feminism? Doubling the workforce. And why did the oligarchs want to double the workforce? Because you cut wages by 50% when you double the workforce. So now you need two people to produce enough to support a family, where before the father alone could support the family and the mother could stay home and raise the children.
Are the oligarchs the ultimate slaves? Because they seem like they're truly deeply in love with money to a degree where, you know, one thing that we always talk about in the stream is no one's having more fun than us. It's like they don't seem like they're having a good time. You know, like I've known some very, very wealthy hedge fund Jewish type men, all they do is work and complain. Is like the higher up you go in this satanic pyramid, are they just a mess?
Well, it's a vice. Avarice is a vice. Avarice is one of the seven deadly sins. We're back with Logos again. This is Logos.
Yeah.
There is an order to be you can be a skinflint, or you can be spend like a drunken sailor. They're both wrong. What you have to do is find the logos in the middle, which means you know the proper use of money, how to use money properly, put it to good use, get some type of return from your investment, raise a family with it, use good use of money, using money, let's say, to create an income-producing piece of property that will give you a return on your investment. Yeah, that's what money's there to do.
It's like your story with Culture Magazine, where someone gave you, I think, like $40,000 or something, and instead of spending it on nonsense, you started something that is still alive and well and creating, you know.
I think that's $40,000 was more then than it is now. But I have lived off of $40,000 for 40 years now. Well, how can you do that? How is that possible? Well, because you created an income-producing property known as Culture Wars Magazine, Fidelity Press, and I can get a return because it allows me to sell the books. And because I can sell those books, I can sell the books that I produce, I can be independent.
Yeah,
that is the basis of independence.
And you create value, you know, and that's the main thing. It's not this parasitic, you know, the ducats, my ducats can copulate or whatever, like that sick, weird thing of just adding zeros. When you create value, it's a good life. Like someone just wrote me, "Hi, Big Bear. 1 year ago, I followed Jordan Peterson, Rogan, Ben Shapiro, Scott Adams, all anti-Logos. Today, I listen to you, Vox, Roosh, and E. Michael Jones, all follow Logos. Logos is rising. Keep it up. It's making impact." See, that's okay. Like when people call me like anti-American or anti-military, like these war hawk psychopaths, like a high ranking military guy just sent me his hatchet from war, because I don't think people understand how much the military despises the chicken hawks like Ben Shapiro that want to start another war because he's a little paranoid about other sovereign nations like Iran. Like the military hates that shit, you know? And I don't think like that's now starting to be known. That these war hawk, you know, neocon types, the Trotskyites, that isn't okay, that our patriotic military men are being sent into places to die and get PTSD for literally the paranoid delusions of a bunch of Jewish people.
That's right. That's got to stop. That's what got me writing the Jewish Revolutionary Spirit. It was watching our country get drawn into that war in Iraq.
Yep.
And I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I knew it. I knew they were lying to me. Why isn't anybody else aware of this? And that's what happened.
That's what happened. That got me going too, man. It's because I thought like maybe it was oil or something. When I saw Netanyahu saying that about weapons of mass destruction and him saying the same thing about Iran and having the mainstream media not fact check, like well, this was bullshit in Iraq, and it cost us trillions and all these lives of our brothers and neighbors and friends. And it's like, and the whole point, they don't even know what's good for them. They took out Saddam. Now they have Iran united with Turkey and Syria. Like, they're not even good war strategists. And now they want to do it again? Like, they're going to lead to their own destruction, which is what happens when you reject logos. And they're living in this paranoid, deluded world where you have, you know, even Wikipedia has taken a shot at me now. They said that I summed up Jews as sodomy Jews and usury Jews or something, or war Jews and sodomy Jews, where it's just these two sides. And of course, it's not all Jews. It's just these forces. One is trying to create constant war, and the other is trying to degrade the population's family. And it's all just simple paranoia based on nonsense.
Yeah. It's based on absence of logos.
Exactly.
Which leads to fear. Because there's no limits. Logos is limit. Logos is a measure, a border. And you say, okay, that's the border. I don't want to go past that because that's breaking the limit. Well, they don't have that sense because they rejected logos. So they always push it too far. And then there's a reaction, and then they don't know what to do. And they know they're pushing it too far, and that's why they create fear. That's why there's this constant fear among these people. This is how the SPLC used to get money from these people. It would scare the shit out of these little Jews, you know, who were afraid that, you know, because some guy in Michigan was going to open up Auschwitz again and put them all in ovens or something like that. And they went for it. They fell for it.
And the reason it's swinging back is now the fear is so much greater that you won't be able to have a job, or your son will come home, you know, at 8 years old saying, I want to take hormones because my teacher told me to. Like, the fears are now swinging back. So the mass population is starting to be like, okay, we have to seriously go back to the thing that we all took for granted, which was the foundational Christian. And I will say, I'm starting to get a lot more respect for Catholicism. You know, I mean, the Pope and a lot of the upper echelon, I know that, you know, I'm not going to go too hard at him because I have a lot of respect for you and stuff, but like the Pope, the governmental system of the Catholic Church right now has been corrupted by, I'm guessing, the homosexuals of the Jesuits. And bear in mind, my godfather is a Benedictine monk. So like, I didn't want this to be true. But like, when you look back at those neighborhoods, at how good the Catholic Church kept things together and kept the Jewish nonsense away from Hollywood and our children, it's a real shame that somehow this blackmail or whatever the hell happened to create, you know, this sexualization of the clergy and the Catholic Church. It's really sad.
Yeah. So the question is, has the consciousness stuck? Or as David Axelrod right and Pete Buttigieg right, it was a momentary aberration, and we're all going to go back to business as usual. That's what's at stake here.
Well, the thing is the consciousness is God, so it can't be taken down. I mean, even if it's 1,000 years, I don't think it's going to be. But we all instinctively know that the anus isn't a sex organ. We all know that an 8-year-old can't choose to be transsexual. We all know that we shouldn't topple nations because a bunch of Jews are paranoid. Like consciousness is God. So it's like, you can't go against what is.
You can, because God gave you free will.
But if you do it,
there is a price to pay. And that's what's becoming apparent now. What's the price that we had to pay for unlimited sexual liberation? What's the price? Because we did have to pay a price.
Right. But to see then, like, when you speak truth, there's always a price too. But the price is oddly freeing. You know, like, you get fired from academia. And as someone whose parents were professors, you didn't miss anything. And just like me, I got kicked out of basically Sodom. You know, it's like at the time, it's almost like speaking truth will get you this penalty, but it's almost like, to penalize you, we won't keep shoving hot pokers in your ass. It's like, fine. You know, the penalty for going against Logos is so much worse. You know, you lose everything good. You lose the ability of discerning your environment. That's why so many Jews aren't like evil. They're just so confused that, just like what you talk about with that Cohen movie, with a serious man, they're so trained to be bullied and held down by just more powerful Jews, because the entire structure is based on power and manipulation. Like, the Talmud is basically just like a legal handbook to how to get around anything. You know, how to argue your way around any truth is the Talmud. It's just, it's confusing as hell.
Yes, yes. This is the issue here. Heinrich Graetz, I've said this before, but Heinrich Graetz said Polish Jews were corrupted by reading the Talmud. That is the father of Jewish historiography. I bring this up because the publisher of the Slovakian edition of the Jewish Revolutionary Spirit wrote to me and said he's worried about going to jail in Slovakia because they passed the International Holocaust Remembrance Accord definition of anti-Semitism, which is basically anything a Jew doesn't like will send you to jail now. This is the type of future that you can expect if you continue down this road of indulging your passions.
Oh, yeah.
In defiance of reason. They will take over.
And what they don't get is the jails fill up quickly. It always has a response that they can't imagine. Like, at the time, they're like little kids that want to have candy, and then they have a stomach ache. And I had a Czech Jewish grandmother that converted to Catholicism, so I know that it isn't ethnic. It is about rejection of Christ, even though I do think I'm a little bit tricky somewhere in me. I'm just kidding. All right, so someone wrote to me, Dr. Jones, you say capitalism is usury. If we do away with the interest, is it still a good economic system? And if not, what is better? Just trade? That's from Richard.
Yeah, what's better is investing in the company. There are two options. If you have a company and you need money, if you sell stock to someone, that is a legitimate use of your money because you are sharing risk. If you share risk, you deserve a return on your investment. There is no shared risk in a loan. That is why it's immoral. So if your company borrows money and you have a bad year, they come and take your company. They take your farm. Tough luck. That's the problem here. So you have to share risk through something like stock rather than no shared risk through a loan.
That's a great answer. Yeah, that's why my business relationships are always based on sharing profits. That way, if the boat goes down, we go down. If not, it doesn't. But I'm not going to take a percentage loan so that if something doesn't work, you get my house. All right. Someone else says, any info on King Edward's Jews? Now he used them to maintain usury as it was outlawed.
The story was all the same throughout Europe. The Jews would go to the sovereign, they'd go to the king and say, if you let us in, we will lend you money at 5% or something like that. The king is always in debt. He's always in need of money at this period of time because we hadn't made the transition to an industrial economy. So the king says, yes. And then the Jew says, well, there's a condition here. We will also lend money to your subjects, but we'll charge them 43 1/3%. King says, okay, that's fine with me. He lets the Jew in, and then suddenly everybody's in debt. Nobody can pay him back. But at this point in history, they know where the Jew lives. They know they know the guy. He lives over there. He's in the ghetto with the other Jews. And at a certain point, we decide, well, we're not going to pay this anymore. I've paid that loan back 5 times already. I'm not going to pay it back anymore. We're going to burn his house down because we know the records are in the house. So if we burn the Jew's house down, we burn his records down as well. This is the dynamic in every country in Europe during the period that we're talking about.
So what is it now? Like, what would be the equivalent of, because I also think it's important that people understand the personal accountability for this stuff. Like, don't take those Discover Card debts. Don't watch their porn. Don't engage in what they're presenting to you. But that being said, what is the equivalent now of burning down the house when 22 trillion, becomes 30 trillion and the interest rate on our nation's debt is more than our entire budget for our military? Like, what happens then?
Well, you have the demographic that in many ways holds the upper hand now. Your demographic is, as I understand it, is like 20-year-olds, 28-year-old, that type of thing. These are guys who are burdened with education debt. They have student loans and they can't get jobs. If those people could organize, and then threaten default, that would be a significant threat to the entire system. That would be the equivalent of burning down the Jews' house. But they have to be organized. Occupy Wall Street was an early attempt to do this. I was there at Occupy Wall Street. It was all 20-year-olds holding up little cards that said, I'm $50,000 in debt and all I can get is an unpaid internship. That was an act of injustice against an entire generation of people. Okay, that was unfair of them to do that. And this, the only way they can do the equivalent of what I just mentioned is if they organize and act as one man. Because the standard thing is if you owe the bank $10,000 and you can't pay it back, you're in trouble. If you owe the bank $10 million and you can't pay it back, the bank's in trouble. And what we have here is $1.5 trillion worth of loans that if one person were the owner of that and one person could act on that, every bank would be in trouble. This could tip the economy. This could tip the economy in the same way that the housing bubble tipped the economy in 2008.
Yeah, and one thing I don't think people understand is the absolute lack of emotion behind a lot of oligarchs, where if you go high enough with Goldman Sachs and stuff like that, they're literally just looking at sheets of risk and benefit. So if somehow people could figure out a way to mass default on some of this stuff, they would just calmly be like, okay, we'll call this number, and it's all over. This is not unusual.
This is not unusual. Yeah. Because Donald Trump did it three times. Basically, what it is, when you declare bankruptcy, you go in and say, okay, you guys, the creditors are going to have to take a haircut. That's what a haircut is. Okay, you're going to get 10 cents on the dollar. I'm sorry, but that's you risked the money you lost. You're going to get 10 cents on the dollar. Now, if the entire millennial generation could go into bankruptcy proceedings and say, okay, take 10 cents on the dollar, that would be huge. I mean, that would be a huge step in the right direction.
Yeah, because laws don't mean anything if you don't follow them. Because right now, you can't default on student debt.
This is unjust.
And it also doesn't mean anything.
If Donald Trump can default three times, why can't some poor schmuck who has a student loan, why can't he default? Well, because the law pushes these people around.
Well, I mean, the colleges, I mean, I used to be so proud that my father was a professor. I was like, you know, that means he's smart. Now I see it as this. It's almost like to create indentured servitude while simultaneously extending, you know, adolescence right through some of your most fruitful, you know, where you should be having children, where you should be working.
Right. You should be forming families at this point. The biggest challenge of anyone in his 20s is to get together and form a family, because that will create you as a person.
Exactly.
This will create you. You're nobody till somebody loves you. Dean Martin used to sing that. You will become a person because you're merging with another person. That person accepts you. You accept that person. That's what creates you. And out of that union, you have children. This is what life is, more than civilization.
And as much as Pete, you know, the gay mayor tries, life will not come out of his boyfriend's ass.
Oh, because there's no other there.
Right.
They are two people who are the same. You don't have that fascination with this member of the opposite sex where you just find that woman completely fascinating and she's completely different and yet she likes you. This is a huge experience. They don't have it. They cannot have it. That cannot come out of that relationship. It's two mutual narcissistic masturbators engaging in their own fantasies. And now the government's gotten involved, or the Pritzker family is going to foist this on all of us, the entire country.
Yeah, and the lack of family, I think, is drawing people away from Logos. I didn't pray for 20 years until my wife was in labor. You know, like, you don't really, like, submit to like the greatness of God until there's some, I mean, some people can. Just in my life, it was like until that moment of like, please, please God, like let my child live. And then that starts the path to truth. And I think that if you're just, you know, butt pumping your fake boyfriend and exchanging clothes and trying to take over, you know, a country with nonsense, like you don't have that connection. And then the problem is they inflict it on us. And the only way out of it is just to start these small communities with close connections to your neighbors. You know, so many people don't even know their neighbors' names. That's one thing that I'm doing actively to try and get out of this hell that these people are creating for us is make your own community, because families and communities are so less likely to fall for this nonsense. And yeah. I think that's why Hillary Clinton despised the deplorables, is because they fell for it. Did you freeze again? You'll come back. Yeah, what happened here?
I said here that the way out is unprotected intercourse.
Yes.
In every sense of the term. Okay, what we're engaging right now is unprotected intercourse. Unprotected intercourse in marriage leads to children, it leads to the bonding of man and wife, it leads to the creation of the family, and the family is what makes you strong. The family allows you to stand up to some type of tyrant who fired you for no good reason and say, we're going to continue. We're not going to let you get us down.
That's so true, man. It's like, I don't think people should ever use condoms. It's like, if you're putting a piece of plastic on your dick, you should not be having sex with that person. That might have been
I had a friend who used to say, put it on any other place, but not that place.
Right. Because it's like, I'm not saying have unprotected, dangerous sex. I'm saying don't have sex unless there's, it's either like enjoyment with your wife or to create children. If not, you know, it's almost like the
gun. You shouldn't be doing it.
Exactly. Either,
if that's not what it is, then don't do it. Very simple.
Or else you fall down the nonsense. You know, you can't argue the point. It's very similar to abortion. When people say, well, 8 weeks is okay. Well, what about 20 weeks? What about 2 weeks? What about 40 weeks? It's like, it's either all or nothing. If you sterilize sex with a condom or with a pill, you don't have a leg to stand on with sodomites. And then once you justify that, then you have transgenders. Then you have the amount. I don't think people are taking responsibility when they say, oh, there's 1,000 genders now. Can I just be a unicorn? It's like, well, you sterilized your dick and had sex with people you didn't love or want children with. So why the hell can't that person be a unicorn sodomite and now control your government? Like, it starts with everybody's decisions.
That's right. That's exactly right. And it didn't happen overnight. It began in the 60s with the legitimatization of contraception. That was the big battle in the 60s. You know, and everybody thought, oh, it's not going to affect anything. You know, well, it affected everything, because once you separated procreation from sex, you opened the door to Pete Buttigieg. And who's going to rule you with an iron rod? He's going to be your tyrant.
Exactly. And you deserve it. That's it. That's why I'll say this stuff. And people are like, man, you've gotten really like, you've gotten like really puritanical. And I'm like, it's not even puritanical. The Puritans were actually more self-justifying. It's like, from a rhetorical point of view, from a dialectic point of view, you can't justify sterilized sex and not allow sodomy. And then once that happens,
it's logical. That is completely logical. That is what led the logos of sex. Either you accept the logos of sex, or you accept some homosexual tyrant who's going to rule you from Washington and Hollywood. It's that simple.
It's the same with abortion. It's like, some people are like, well, at 8 weeks, it's like, what's the difference between 8 weeks and 20 weeks and 40 weeks and 1 week? It's all a conceived life. You don't have an ability of arguing that, because now all these people that see the 40-week, you know, third trimester abortion, which is obviously murder, all of it's murder, but like, when they see that, they're like, how did this happen? It's like, because you were killing 8 week olds. And it's like, it's the same with sterilized sex. All right, someone wrote, thank you for the work you do, Owen. Thanks to people like you and E. Michael Jones, I think I found God. Have you seen Paul VI Audience Hall at the Vatican? pretty scary. The architecture has serpentine imagery in it. The Pope stands in front of that of a ghastly sculpture called the Resurrection, but I don't think it's Christ these guys are trying to resurrect. Any thoughts on that? Obviously, I'm sure you have.
Yeah, I've seen the doctored photo. You can turn it into a – there's a window behind the Pope. You can turn it into a snake's head with Photoshop. Okay, that's what we're talking about here.
Okay, so that's just Photoshop. Because so many people have never been – I've never been in there, so I don't really know.
I've been there.
Oh, cool. Okay, so what happened to the hierarchy of – was it Jesuits? Because this Pope is now advocating for open borders, and I'm not asking you to talk.
Look, it's very simple. The sexualization that took place in the 60s included the clergy. The clergy were being sexualized. If you want to know the story about Notre Dame, I wrote a book called Is Notre Dame Still Catholic? Notre Dame was the epicenter of subversion of the Catholic Church's teaching on contraception. Hesburgh was working for the Rockefellers. It's that simple. The Rockefellers saw the main obstacle to universal acceptance of contraception as the Catholic Church, and they set about to change that. That's what happened. And the clergy were sexualized at this time, a period of time as well. The ones who were heterosexual married and left because you have to leave. The ones who were homosexual stayed. And as a result, the incidence of homosexuality increased over time in the Catholic clergy.
Yeah, that's the thing is that abstinence is so important. And so if you open the door, you're going to draw deviants versus really good people that are willing to take the vow. And I think wasn't a lot of that because of psychiatry?
Yes. Erik Erikson was the basis for a survey that Eugene Kennedy did of the Catholic priesthood in 1972. And he had the stages of development. Well, stage six is sexual intercourse. If you don't have sexual intercourse, you cannot be a mature person. Well, guess what? Every priest and nun took a vow of celibacy. So therefore, they could not be mature. This had a devastating effect on the morale of the clergy, and it opened the door to sexual experimentation and the corruption of the clergy.
Wow. Yeah, you've helped me forgive a lot of that stuff from my childhood because a lot of that hypocrisy I saw was a by-design detonating bomb that had started in the 60s and just kept going. And that doesn't take away from the natural law. Like, humans can't, like, make it go away. You just go through hard times. All right. Hey, Big Bear, on the topic of how the Catholic Church fell, there's a book coming out at the end of May by Dr. Taylor R. Marshall titled Infiltration, The Plot to Destroy the Catholic Church from Within. He's a good Catholic man who did a lot of research for the book. Got to be verified as Bearer of Wisdom. Welcome, Bearer of Wisdom. Have you heard of this book? Do you have any thoughts on it?
I haven't heard of the book, no. But there's plenty of research that needs to be done here. I mean, there's lots of stories. I dealt with this in Africa. There are nuns there who are doing PhDs on counseling, psychology. I'm telling them, look, you don't have the story. You don't know what happened. You have to come over here, and I'll show you the people. I'll show the orders of nuns that went out of business, and I'll explain to you why it happened. It just didn't happen. There were attacks on these group of people, and psychology was one of the main vehicles that got weaponized in this attack.
Yeah, I've never had any interest in seeing a psychiatrist. Like, the fact Freud said you want to kill your father and have sex with your mother, like, I don't know how that rang true to anybody. That just sounds like madness. And then they become the confessional, and you pay them to have them justify your heinous acts. And then I have a weird theory that they use celebrities, because every celebrity I knew would go to a psychiatrist, and I think that they're a form of handler where they develop a file of all the sick, twisted things that you've said or done, and then they use that as blackmail.
That's right. You know who the master of that was? It was Alfred Kinsey.
Yeah.
The guy who wrote the Kinsey Report, in order to talk to him, you had to give him your sex history. Well, guess what? If you gave him your sex history, he could blackmail you. Why didn't I think of that? And so the only thing that stopped Alfred Kinsey was a bigger blackmailer, and that bigger blackmailer was J. Edgar Hoover,
right,
who made a career out of blackmail. had dossiers on every single congressman in Washington. If they gave him any shit or cut his budget, he threatened to expose what he knew about them.
And that's why it's so important to face your demons and not be blackmailable, because it's a power that I don't think people understand. Where, you know, my wife, you know, she knows all my everything about me at this point. We've been through so much stuff, and people have tried to use to fracture me and her, and we just laugh about it, because there's like, when you live an honest life, there's no way that they can get to you. And so many people are just so terrified that like some little detail will come out. And when you don't have that little detail, you're a force to be reckoned with.
Yeah. Unless you become a homosexual, and then no one's allowed to say anything about you.
I know. And some people are saying, I used to think that they're trying to normalize pedophilia, but I almost think that they need one more thing left to shame people with. Because once they go full no shame, how the hell do they blackmail anybody?
That's right.
I don't know. What do you think? Did you freeze again? You'll come back. I will not let the Jews take me down. Yeah.
Look at Joe Biden.
Okay.
Did he do what Bill Clinton did? Was he like a Bill Clinton? It doesn't seem that. I don't know for sure. But the stuff that they're talking about is him being hugging inappropriately or something like that. Well, how does that compare with what Pete Buttigieg does on a regular basis? Why is somehow Biden being criticized, and we shudder to think what Pete Buttigieg does at the gay bathhouses or the gay bars in Chicago? No one's allowed to talk about that. This is crazy. This is absolutely crazy.
It's crazy, man. He's committed to an act of to a life of subversion and sodomy. But people are starting to talk about it. You know, like bringing back the word sodomite has been very useful, because we used to call, you know, buddies, if someone was being weak or like, you know, someone didn't want to pick you up at the airport, you're like, don't be a fag. And people would be like, oh, you can't say that word anymore. It's homophobic. And I'm like, it's not even, what about straight fags? You know, like, it just didn't make sense to me. And so then when you're not allowed to say certain words, I just went right back to the source and just started calling gay people sodomites. And it's had a pretty amazing effect.
Yeah, well, it situates it in the proper context.
Yeah.
Which would be scripture.
Yeah, and also it separates the sin from the man. It's like you can, that it's actually healthier to be like, oh, that person commits sodomy. And it sounds so intense, but in reality, it's like, well, yeah, that's a sin. You can deal with that. You can get away from that. You can reject that. It's actually not dehumanizing at all. And it's bad. I was going to ask you this. I feel like back in the day, when I would sleep with women I didn't love, it's almost a similar thing to sodomy. It's not, I don't know. Is that sodomy? Because I'm starting to group everything together.
Look, we are all expected to act like homosexuals, even if we're not homosexuals.
Right.
And what is the essence of acting like a homosexual? Engaging in sterile, transient relationships.
Right.
If your relation is sterile and transient, well, then why is it any different than homosexuality?
Exactly. That's how I feel about myself, where that's why I can recognize it in other people and call them out for it, because I'm like, that is like, I've never had anal sex, but like there is a form of sodomy with that transient, sterile sex that in the art world is so pushed upon you. Like, that's kind of like what it is.
That's what my youngest son found himself in this world when he ended up at the Cincinnati Ballet.
Yeah.
This was the norm in artistic circles. You don't have to be a homosexual, but you have to act like a homosexual. And the essence of that is transient, sterile relationships. And so what he did is he refused that. He fell in love with a woman. They got married.
Good.
And then invited everyone to the wedding, and the director didn't show up. You know, everyone else showed up. The director of the ballet didn't show up. And then what does she do? She punishes them. She fires my son and promotes my daughter as a direct act of aggression against her family. So what does my daughter-in-law do? She gets pregnant.
Nice.
And what does the ballet do? Four ballerinas get pregnant. at the same time. This is unheard of. This is a rebellion against transient, sterile relationships. They are being exploited financially and every other way because they're supposed to do this until they're 35 years old, and suddenly you can't have children, and your career is over, and what do you do now? It's unfair to these people. Yeah, it's unfair, and they did something constructive. Four people now exist in this world who would not have existed otherwise because of this evil.
I love it. And women just need leadership. Women react more to groupthink than men do, like hence Woodstock and stuff like that. A lot of these things were designed to make women in group think that that's something to do. And then if you have one leader, like your daughter-in-law, women are like, oh, that's actually the life I want. And that's beautiful. You know, and I always thought it was interesting that women never got mad at me. Like I never had any stalkers. I didn't have these bad vibes in my life. And then I realized that it's because women are being trained that they don't want relationships, even though they really do. And it's just this sterile, you know, garbage bag blowing in the breeze. Like they didn't care at all about me. You know, it wasn't like back in the day where it'd be like a woman really loved you, and if you had sex with her and then you didn't call her back, she'd be like angry at you. Now the culture is they don't even care, and that's supposed to make men feel good. It's like you're a neutered dog humping a leg. You know, it's not masculinity.
That's why there's no opera anymore. There's no opera anymore because nobody's living the life of Madame Butterfly, which is predicated on the fact that sex is a big deal.
Right. Yeah, my dad sang opera. I remember all like La Boheme, La Traviata, all that stuff. It's like it doesn't draw people anymore because the assumptions, you know, the givens are all wacky now.
It's too deep emotionally, and people don't have the emotional capacity to face up to it. It's just a very deep emotional experience, and if your life is nothing but transient, sterile relationships, you won't know how to relate to it. You won't understand it.
I know, and Freud has done so much awful stuff to the world where sexual repression somehow is a bad thing. That's like saying jogging will make you exhausted and you shouldn't do it. It's like that's how you train yourself to be strong, you know, like to not watch porn, to not have sterile relationships. That doesn't repress you so that you explode. It's quite the opposite. It makes you so you don't sexualize the world when you look at it, you know?
Clears the mind. It allows you to perceive reality.
You have to stop watching porn or else you'll never see what the Jews are up to.
That's why they promote it.
Is that really, is it really to cloud your brain? Because
yes.
I truly believe that. When I stopped watching pornography, I started substituting it with educational and kind of conspiracy videos. And I saw so many things that I had never seen before. And
I've given this talk all over the world. In 2002, the Israelis invaded Ramallah and started broadcasting pornography over the Palestinian TV stations. Now, why did they do that? Why did they do that? Because they wanted to bring freedom to the Palestinians? No, because they know it wrecks your mind. It distracts you from the issues at hand. It darkens the mind. It clouds your judgment. They know that. That's why they do it. It's a weapon. They knew that. Why do you think they showed it on Palestinian TV stations? This is proof that it's a weapon.
Yeah, when Jews are giving you something for free all the time, you should wonder what's going on. You know, like how free porn is. It's like it's unlimited HD porn in your pocket all the time. Like, really ask yourself, why would a group of people known for haggling give me all this for free all the time if it isn't to subvert? All right, someone says, can you please tell Dr. E. Michael Jones to tell his gay disco ball story from South Bend?
Well, the mayor, as one of his great achievements, put lights under the bridge in South Bend.
Right.
And when I walk there with my grandchildren, I refer to them as the gay disco lights.
Yeah.
So South Bend is a gay disco. The point here is, though, that America is a gay disco. And this happened when I was in Berlin. I'm riding around bicycle. First time I've been there in 40 years, okay, riding around. And I come to the American Embassy, and there's a bear with a rainbow flag around the bear. The bear is the symbol of the United States and Berlin, the embassy. It's wearing a gay banner. And you look at the thing, and it says, this is in commemoration of what happened in Orlando.
Ugh.
So this is the official statement of the United States of America. This is the embassy of the United States of America, that we are basically a gay disco. The country is a gay disco. So if you're in the military, your job is to die for the gay disco. Now, what we've learned subsequently is that the ambassador to Germany is a homosexual. And as you can expect, he has antagonized the entire German nation. He's swaggering around there, telling them what they have to do, do this and do that. And then Trump, for some insane reason, has now said that it is the job of the United States to overturn anti-sodomy laws any place in the world. And this gay ambassador is the guy who's in charge of that. But, I mean, this is what I'm saying. This is what America is now. It's a gay disco. And if you want to be ruled by an iron rod with this type of tyranny, vote for Pete Buttigieg.
I mean, it's, you're going to take down Buttigieg, and it's going to be glorious. Because all people have to do is have one person connect the dots, and then they see it. You know, most people's lives are very connected to logos. Like, they're not in this nonsense parasitic world of just, like, you know, sodomy and usury. They just don't see it. They just want to be a good guy and not be called names. Like, that's literally our shackles. It's just like, ah, I just don't want to be called a homophobe, whatever, just do your thing. When in reality, that lukewarm mentality will be the end of us.
Yeah, you have to first understand that every homosexual is a commissar. Every homosexual is a proxy warrior who is fighting for the oligarchs to keep you under control. That is what Pete Buttigieg is. He's got the best resume in human history. Okay, I'll even concede he's the smartest guy in the state of Indiana. The only problem is he doesn't represent the interests of anybody in Indiana.
No.
And he's using South Bend as a stepping stone for his narcissistic fantasies. Okay, now for some, God's plan is to have Pete Buttigieg and me on the same street. How probable is that?
Yeah, he's four doors down, and he went to your kid's school and then Harvard.
We've had these parallel lives here, and now suddenly he's famous. And guess what? I'm going to be famous too. Because we're joined at the hip. There's nothing he can do about it.
I love it, man. And it's just like, but the beauty is the amount of effort it takes to get Buttigieg looking good for the world. You know, you got Ellen and you got all this stuff. It takes so little to take him down as long as you're heard. You just say, he thinks the anus is a sex organ and he's propped up by oligarchs. And people just go, oh, that sucks. Because people are so sick of the...
Other than that, he's got a great...
I love your imagery about these homosexual CEOs. They parachute in. I love that rhetorically, where you just picture one of these billionaires just parachuting into South Bend to overturn the will of the people.
That's what it was. They showed their hand when Mark Benioff parachuted in to Indianapolis to tell them to overturn the law they had just passed.
Yeah, and so many people just, you know, the American way of life of just, you do you, I do me, don't tread on me. You know, I'm all about freedom. But what people don't get is they're using that to take away everything. Where it's like, no, you don't. If you get these homosexuals in power, they will overturn everything you hold dear and take away the family structure, which we're now seeing rampantly. We have a lesbian Jewish rabbi in charge of the curriculum for all the elementary schools and all of public education. And people wonder where the hell it's coming from. It's a gay Jewish lady telling everyone to teach little kids about sodomy. Did you freeze again?
Lesbian Jewish rabbi who's in charge of.
Yeah, and so these things, like, they're not coming out of nowhere. And our world is getting so turned upside down that I think people are ready to really start rebelling.
I hope so. It's not an office who woke up, who understand the story, the real story now, who understand why Stephen Colbert is there, why is Ellen DeGeneres there, to tell us what to think. These are all commissars. And the commissar, if you don't follow the party line,